Welcome back to Blocked and Muted with Jim Suhan. I'm here with our producer, Brianne Burdett. And usually I start these shows by offering a bunch of quick hits on local sports, global sports, whatever's going on in the sports world. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. Had a chance to sit down with Brianna Scurry, Minnesota native, Olympic great, who just wrote a book with a friend of mine, Wayne Coffey. It's called My Greatest Save. It's going to be turned into a documentary that'll be out July 12th called The Only. And Brianna is on a national tour promoting her book. Wednesday night she's going to be over, was at a high school with talking to members of the Fusion Soccer Club and all their fans. And we just had a chance, and we have already recorded the interview, so I know how it went. I just think this is a great opportunity for you to hear Brianna's story and to understand what she's gone through. And I think you're going to enjoy the interview, the book, the documentary, if you're a soccer fan, if you're a sports fan, or if you just want to hear a uniquely American story. She went through depression. She contemplated committing suicide. She ended up having a very specialized surgical procedure that basically changed her life. She met the woman of her dreams who helped her through this tough patch. She pawned her Olympic medals, and then her current wife helped her get them back. There's a lot in this book. It's very in depth, and you know, Brianne just sat here and listened to the entire interview, and this is the good stuff. This is when you get to meet somebody who's really special and whose story should be told. Honored and thrilled to have Brianna Scurry here. Never really met you before, and I feel like that's a big miss on my part. We're going to make up for that today. Let's start with this. I read the book, My Greatest Save, and I not only found it entertaining and insightful, I also thought it was very brave. You bare your soul in this book. Was that hard to do?
Not really. Myself, Patrick, my publicist, and my wife and business manager, Krissa, sat down in 2019 and really hashed out what it would be like to write a book. I've always felt I've had one in me for 20 years. It felt like a good time to just see if that was something I was willing to do. And I really had to sit with the idea for quite a while because I wanted to be authentic to my story and tell all of it from the great things to the difficult and hard things. And everything in between. My life and my journey has been really colorful, and I wanted to make that come across in the feeling space of it for the readers. And then when I decided I could do that, and I was willing to go into those rooms of my life that I've had barricaded with locks and, you know, things up against it, and it's dark in there, and I haven't been there in a while, I wanted to go in those rooms and shed some light. And so when I decided I was ready to do that, Patrick, myself, and Krissa started the process, got a literary agent, started, talking to different writers, decided, thankfully, on Wayne Coffey to do the writing with me. And it's been absolutely phenomenal. I think we hit it out of the park. It's truly, essentially, my life and my heart poured out in.
Yeah, and as we were talking off the air, Wayne Coffey, he's one of the best writers in the country. He does these projects and books incredibly well. And writing a book is different than anything we do in daily journalism. It's a discipline. It requires a lot of talent, a lot of insight. I'm thrilled that you ended up working with Wayne on this. Tell me about Krissa. And I'm going to be asking you questions that I know the answer to because I read the book, but I want people to be able to hear things in your voice.
Sure. So I was introduced to Krissa through a very interesting encounter. So a really good friend of mine, Naomi, and her partner, Fran, started a company called Tomboy Exchange on a Kickstarter campaign, which is, where you get funding for your concept. Krissa saw the Kickstarter campaign. She was interested in investing. So she invested in the Kickstarter campaign, and then her and Fran and Naomi talked to each other. They decided they were going to meet, and they had dinner. And at that time, I was really struggling with the insurance company doing the right thing because at that moment, I had been able to get a second opinion from a doctor, go through a process, and my doctor thought that the occipital nerve behind my left ear was damaged and a surgery that was an experimental procedure at the time called occipital nerve release was, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to do this procedure. And he thought that it would literally change the game for me. Insurance company was dragging their feet on doing it, on paying for it. So Krissa owns a PR firm, and she's a CEO, Livewire Strategic Communications. And so Naomi and Krissa talked. Naomi said, maybe you could help Bri with putting a little pressure on the insurance company to do the right thing. I didn't know about any of this. I'm at home at that point, you know, struggling in my own depths of hell, essentially. And Naomi calls me and says, I'd met this amazing person. I think she can help you with the insurance company. You should call her. I said, okay, I'll call. A couple days goes by, I didn't call. Naomi calls me, Bri, if you don't call Krissa today, I'm never speaking to you again. And she meant it. And I called her, we talked. At that point in my life, I was in such pain and so much like financial ruin, essentially, from the insurance company dangling these disability payments, that I just told her everything. And she took that ball and she ran, and she did what she does so well. She called my lawyers and said, I want to put pressure on the insurance company to do the right thing. How do we do that? The lawyers called the insurance company, told them what was potentially going to happen, and they completely changed the game right there, did the right thing, paid for the surgery, a year of therapy after that. And that's how everything changed. And that's Krissa.
Your book is both intensely personal, and it's also a snapshot of America in a lot of ways, you know, dealing with racism, dealing with other forms of bigotry, dealing with big companies that don't want to do the right thing. Right. It's amazing how many buttons it pushed for me. Let's, because Minnesota's, you know, you might've heard of this, Minnesota's a little provincial. Let's go ahead and do the Minnesota aspect of this. Tell me about growing up here. And you really made a point of thanking and praising some of the coaches who really helped you along the way.
Absolutely. Born and raised here. And my family moved from Minneapolis, St. Paul area out into the suburbs of Dayton, right around 5 or 6 years old. They wanted me to get a better education, but we were also the only black family in that area. Dayton, Minnesota, small rural town, no stoplights, just stop signs. And so going out there was a bit of an adventure. I never had an issue with being the only black family in that area. Apparently, some children in that area at my bus stop, one in particular, had issue with me. So he made fun of me, called me Blackie. And the thing I remember so vividly about that incident was his face. He was so angry. He had, you know, vitriol. His face was red. He was literally spitting. And it was like, I was like, what? Why are you, what? I didn't cut you off in line or anything. What is the problem here? And he's like, Blackie, Darkie, and saying all this stuff to me. And I remember crying. And then I went home and told my sister about it, who was 9 years older than me. And she handled it, needless to say. She handled it really well for me. And other than that situation with him, growing up in Dayton, going to elementary school, then Jackson Junior High School and Anoka High School, I really had no issues with race other than that particular instance in my face. I learned later throughout the book process, Wayne talking to, you know, teammates of mine in high school and whatnot, that apparently a lot of people just steered clear of me. I had this, I guess, you know, look on my face that essentially said, I'm not to be trifled with, allegedly, is what they used to say. But obviously, my teammates, I adored them. They adored me. We had great success in every sport I played. Even the ones I stopped playing, like volleyball, we I think we were like 30-0 or something at one point. And so, you know, a lot of great moments, a lot of fun. One of my club team coaches, Pete Swenson, who was with the Brooklyn Park Kickers at the time, his daughter Denise played on the club team. We had fantastic success and from, I'd say, 14 years old till 19 for me, Pete was truly a second dad. I found this out also later in the book process that Pete was a financial assistance for my mom and dad for me to play because, you know, back then it obviously wasn't thousands of dollars to play, but it was a considerable expense. And so when you're a family, you know, like blue class working family, like my mom and dad were, they didn't have a ton of money to spend on traveling and whatnot for their daughter, but clearly saw something in me. I was very active, played a lot of sports, and they wanted me to play and to be able to do that with the soccer because it is expensive. Pete was willing to chip in and participate. So he was truly an absolute just hero in my parents' eyes. He also was very instrumental in his connection with Jim Rudy, who had been recruiting his daughter, Denise, to go to University of Central Florida when he was the coach there. Jim essentially then moved to UMass and was coaching there the next year, and Jim and Pete were in communication still, even though Denise chose to go to UConn. And Pete said, "Hey, I got a goalkeeper for you." And Jim said, "I don't think I need one." I have literally...
There's a very good one there.
Yes, a very good one. I'm all set in that area, Pete. But Pete said, "You've never seen this one. You need this one." And from then on, Pete helped not only my family financially, but help grease the wheels, if you will, with Jim Rudy at UMass. And essentially Jim had two All-American goalkeepers at UMass at the same time.
Yeah. And there are times in the book where you talk about your development and ended up going to college and all this, and you sounded like you were surprised by these developments. And then then as a more mature player, you were very confident. When did you make the transition from being kind of in awe of all the possibilities to saying, "Hey, I'm good"?
I actually, the you could call it being naive, or you could call it just someone who is just doing their thing out there and not really thinking about where or how I fit in compare myself to other people. I was told by Jim Rudy at UMass my sophomore year that he thought I was good enough to play on the national team. I said, "Great, coach. I didn't know we had one." Ooh, there's the naive part, right? No idea. And he's like, "Yeah, we do. They just won the World Cup in 1991 in China." And he said, I think you're good enough to play on it. So I said, "Hey, if you have confidence in me, coach, I have confidence in me, and I'll just take that and use it if you don't mind. So thank you." And I did. And he ended up being such a great choice for me because not only was he a great coach overall, but he was literally essentially a master class of goalkeeping. And it was as simple as you could get it. Two hands, catch the ball. Your feet, get your hands to the ball. Like all these simple concepts that made me from a great athlete when I came into UMass my freshman year into a great goalkeeper by the time I left.
Tell me about your favorite moments with the U.S. Women's National Team.
Ooh, well, as it turned out, Jim Rudy, my coach at UMass, knew Anson Dorrance, who was the head coach at UNC, and also wore a second cap as head coach of the women's national team at the same time. And so throughout the book process, we learned that the two of them had been talking my entire college career. They were talking. And so Anson knew of me, and then I had an opportunity to play in front of him in the NCAA Final Four my senior year in college, and we got completely shredded 4-1. But apparently I played well enough because a week or two later, he called me into camp. And so my first camp at Cocoa Expo in Florida was just an eye-opener. I mean, that level to jump from college to national team, and we're not talking about just a national team. We're talking about the best on the planet national team. So that jump is like enormous threw me into the deep end of the pool, number 5 out of 5 on the totem pole for goalkeepers. And boy, I was just, I was just swimming as fast as I could that whole week. I must have had 1,000 goals by me. I mean, you know, Michelle Akers was there, Mia Hamm was there, you know, Karen Gabera. Talk about the best forwards in the world. Just 4v4, shredding, just scoring left and right. And I'm like a fish out of water, flopping around, trying to be Jim Craig in there, just spinning on my head the whole week. And I thought I had just given up way too many goals. It was just breathtaking. So I go into my exit meeting and I sit down and I don't really know what to expect. And Anson and Tony come in and they're like, "Hey, Bri." I'm like, "Hi, guys." And they sat down and they said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Ooh, how much time do you have? I think I'm not coming back." I didn't say that, but I was thinking that in my mind. And they said, "I did great." They said, "You had a great week." I said, "Okay, if you say so." I guess if I had gotten 2,000 goals scored on me, would that have been better? I don't know. But it turns out that what I didn't know was Anson's philosophy about players. And he said that his philosophy was, if I see great potential in a player that I can work with, that's the player I want. So he saw that great athletic potential that he thought he could mold into a goalkeeper, and also my attitude. So even though I get a ton of goals scored on me that first week, I was still showing up every training session, getting better as the training session went on, as opposed to getting worse and letting it change my mental outcome. I just got more determined as opposed to demoralized. And that's what he saw and that's what he liked.
We don't have to talk about the darker aspects of your book unless you want to. I'll leave it up to you. Okay,
yeah.
Good. I just, you know, I didn't want to feel forced.
Sure.
But it kind of, frankly, it made me angry as I'm reading those passages that, you know, here's an American star, an American hero in the richest country on earth. And let's face it, we also spend a lot of money on sports.
Right.
It just really bothered me that you ended up in the place you ended up. Why do you think things went so poorly for you post-career?
I think I just partially fell through the cracks. So at the time that I had my concussion, I was in the league. It was April 2010. I had this concussion. The situation was bad for me. It was unlike any concussion I had before. The symptoms would roll. Like they would come and they'd fade and they'd come back and they'd fade. And so I was literally just going deeper and deeper into depression along the way and not getting the treatment and the assistance that I needed. I woke up every morning hoping that the headache was gone. It just kept being there. It was there. So that was like a force pushing on me. And I literally was fighting it because it morphed into a workers' comp situation essentially when my career ended from that year. So my situation changed, my status changed to workers' comp. And so when it went from an athlete that's injured to a workers' comp situation, it just got a whole different classification than a different set of rules in a different game, essentially. And in that realm, it was deny on the insurance company's part. Although, obviously, the injury occurred during my work, my shift, if you will, on the field in a game. There's video, you know what I mean? And I think that was a big part of it. I feel like if the insurance company had been more understanding and not trying to tell me that it was all in my head, they were right about it all being in my head, but it, not in the way they meant it. It would have been a lot better. I think I probably could have shaved at least half the amount of time it took, which was what ended up being roughly 3 years and change. It probably could have been like maybe a year, if not even that, because I found the doctor way earlier than the time I was allowed to see him and able to see him. And then the process of the procedure and all of that just getting stretched out every time at every turn. And that's what was the beginning of the slide. And because it stretched out, the agony and the anxiety that I had about winning every single court case against the insurance company, but yet they would stop payment of my disability payments. And that was the financial piece. And so I would be behind in my rent and my bills and all these other things. And I asked friends to help. But I mean, how many times can you go to that well? You know what I mean? I just didn't feel like I could keep asking them. And I started to feel like a burden. And I'm, you know, I'm Brian Escurry. I shouldn't be in this space, in this position, in this, and having these feelings about it. And I just felt ashamed, essentially. And at the time, I didn't realize it was the concussion that the basket of feelings came from there. And I didn't know that at the time. And it wasn't until I met Dr. Crutchfield, the right doctor, he explained it to me that that's what was happening. And I got to a point where the headaches were so bad. I mean, just every day. And as the day wore on, they got worse. The pain was just excruciating. It was literally like feeling like I had a pick in the back of my head. And it was just like, you know, trying to essentially split my skull in half every day by the end of the day. And so I'd self-medicate with Vicodin and alcohol. And that's obviously a bad combination, but it just, I just, you know, rolling into that gutter every day. And I got to a point where I was suicidal in 2013. And when I started thinking about how, that's when I knew I was in real trouble. And then I got to the edge of the waterfalls that was near my house where I lived, and I would stand there. And when it rained a lot, these falls would just be, you know, the flow would just be intense. And I couldn't swim. And so I knew if I went in, I wouldn't come out. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I thought about my mom, who was battling Alzheimer's at the time. I had a vision of her sitting on her bed, being notified by the police, a knock at the door, her going down and them telling her her baby was gone. And it was that moment that put me on a different path, because I was like, I can't do this to her. I cannot. And so that got me off the edge, literally. And then, as I had mentioned earlier, Naomi and Krissa, shortly after that, were talking to each other and having a conversation about me. And then I got thrown that lifeline. So I got off the ledge. I'm still in the pit, though. The lifeline comes. I get the procedure. I feel much better. And I'm off and running. And then the 1 year of therapy after that, and before I knew it, I was feeling, I can't even tell you how much better about everything. And that was the beginning of a new beginning.
And I was so relieved when you got to the point where you and Krissa went and got the medals back. Where are they displayed now?
They are.
Oh, right here.
They are right here.
Our security is not good enough here for you to be carrying those around right here.
Let me show you the girls.
Oh, wow.
So this is the box for two of them are in here. This is 96.
Wow. I actually get to touch them. Yes. She doesn't know me very well, obviously. Atlanta, 96.
And this is Athens, Greece, 2004.
Beautiful. Oh, wow. This one I really like.
That one's actually so cool. Heavier, even
it
though
is,
smaller.
It is, I can tell, yeah.
And that's now the current, the face on that one is the face of all the medals now.
That is so cool.
They have new meaning for me, as you can imagine.
Yes. Yes. Well, let's before I let you go, let's talk big picture here.
Okay.
It feels like women's sports are on the rise, which is great. Soccer's on the rise in America, I believe. We're also talking about a country where the Supreme Court is trying to take away a lot of rights right now, specifically targeting you.
Yes, I mean, in all sorts of ways,
yeah,
right?
So take either or both. How are you feeling about being an American these days?
Oh, last week felt similar to me in the sense that when I was playing in the 2004 Olympics, I was mourning my father passing. At the same time, I was about to embark on an adventure that I had wanted since I was 8 years old. So I was going to play in another Olympic Games two months later. So the two opposing feelings were raging at a high decimal at the same time. This last week was very similar for me. I started my book tour. It was the 50-year anniversary of Title IX. It wasn't that long ago we got equal pay for the women's national team for soccer. That had been a 30-year journey doing that. We finally got everything. Cindy Parlow-Cohn, a teammate, is the president of the federation. Oh my gosh, we're all going in the right direction. This is wonderful. Holy cow. Wham. Supreme Court decision comes down exactly this, in the same week, the next day after the 50-year anniversary of Title IX. So it's a very similar feeling of this is great, this is awesome what we're doing, but gutted on the other side. It's when you're trying to fight and win rights, it is a long journey and a process. I don't think a lot of people understand how long these things take to happen. The Supreme Court decision has been in the making for many years. And you could see it from a long way off where it was trending, but you really didn't want to believe it, that it was going that way. And so last week was probably one of the most phenomenal, impactful weeks for women all over this country. And I am angry. I am astonished at what Justice Clarence Thomas had to say, because that is literally targeting me. I am a woman. I am openly gay. I am legally married to my wife. And I feel like someone who is married to a white woman, so he has an interracial marriage, should understand that what he's doing is not right. What he's saying is not fair. And I am astonished that he doesn't understand that. So I'm hopeful that with the other justices, even though they are conservative, that voted to overturn Roe v. Wade will not come after my marriage.
Yeah, I'm not real hopeful, but let's try to be hopeful here in this moment. Last thing for today, and if you ever want to come back on the network, we'd love to have you. I appreciate you being here today. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the tour. Looking forward to seeing you on Wednesday night. Sounds like, you know, at least small picture, your life's pretty good now, huh?
Woo! Yeah. Big picture, yeah. My life is pretty good now. Yeah, so this book has been a 2-year journey for Wayne and myself, and we are here. We've birthed it. It feels just like winning an Olympic gold medal. With the elation of winning, essentially, but also the relief of having it finished and out into the world and having it be there for all types of people. I mean, I would say that my book can help anyone who reads it, and also anyone that they care about, it can help them. So I would be remiss if I didn't say, I think my book is worth reading. Also, I did the audio version in my voice. And cool. So if you'd rather listen to it, you can do that too. But what I will say is I am one of the luckiest women I know, because I have a fantastic marriage with my wife, Krissa. I have two fantastic stepchildren, Andrew and Sydney. I have a dog. I have a pool. I have a life that I didn't necessarily think I would have for a long time. Not only the book is out, I'm going to be broadcasting with CBS Paramount Plus next month for the Women's World Cup qualifiers.
Excellent.
I have a documentary coming out with CBS Paramount Plus on July 12th called The Only. It is essentially the visual representation of my book and my journey. There's some fantastic interviews in there with my teammates and my family. Really looking forward to that. And I just feel like I'm a bamboo tree. I've grown all these root systems in the ground for a long time, and now I'm coming out. I'm coming out of the ground. So I'm just really excited about this time in my life and really, really having a great time with the book tour and meeting people and like you and coming back to my home state.
Well, I appreciate you being here. I highly recommend the book. And what I love about the book is if you can read it as a soccer fan and learn things about soccer in America and the U.S. Women's National Team, or you can read it for all the reasons we just talked about. It's about America. It's about real life. It's about, you know, and I think so many of us have discovered the last 5-10 years just that most people are dealing with something.
Yes. Yeah?
And yours is an extreme case and a sad case and that had a happy ending, but we all know people who have struggled.
Absolutely. And I also do a lot of keynote speeches. I'm an inspirational speaker with corporations and schools, universities, organizations. And every time I am about to go on stage in my mind and I say a little prayer, please let me say the right words to reach into the heart of the person that needs to hear them. And I think Wayne and I in the book hit that nail on the head. And it will reach you wherever you are.